Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The War Room, our interview series brought to you as part of the Clone Star Pod. I am your host, Mike Overton, and joining me in the co-host seat this week is the wonderful Joseph Hurley. How are you, Show?
Hi, Mike. Thanks very much for inviting me on.
No worries at all. Now, my guest this week is an incredible storyboard artist and director who's worked on a really tiny little show that not many people have heard of before called Star Trek Lower Decks. My guest this week is the wonderful Meg Lloyd. Meg, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sorry, we've had a really good natter before the recording, so I'm still laughing.
We're best friends already. Oh, yeah.
The unfortunate thing is we did find out that Meg's cat has actually got a Star Wars name, yes. Not a Star
How
Trek
did you
name.
You rat so me out this so early.
Credibility now is kind of under threat already. So Meg, you've really got to impress the audience here with the kind of stories about what's going on. Kind of get that credibility.
You can love more than one thing. It in fact makes you a more well-rounded storyteller.
I mean, I'm looking behind you and I see a TARDIS. I see, is that a...
So this is the Indominus.
Indominus. I was trying to think of the name, but yes, the Indominus.
It's specifically the Camp Cretaceous brand Indominus Rex, which nice. Is a kids-focused Jurassic World TV show that I storyboarded on in 2018 and 2019.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Lots of goodies behind you and lots of plants as well.
They are all fake. They are just for show.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't own any real plants. They die after about a week, so I've given up.
And Meg, actually, there's three books there, blue, yellow, red. They're not to do with Star Trek, are they, by any chance? Or what are they?
Because they are not, even though they are the correct division colors. The purple mm-hmm. book stacked on top of them doesn't read quite well, but these are my hardcover Stormlight Archive books from Brandon Sanderson, who's one of my favorite fantasy authors. So this bookshelf that you see behind me is the specifically nicest books I own that would look good on a Zoom. And there's like three more, much more miscellaneous shelves scattered throughout the apartment. But we've got Brandon Sanderson first edition hardcovers and nice 10th anniversary leather bounds. Nice. We have Art of Miyazaki films, my Dungeons and Dragons books, and storyboard things. And then these bottom two shelves are Art of books for a lot of different animated and live action movies that I find inspiring.
Awesome.
And I love books those on the floor.
Where they belong. No, I'm joking. No, I love those Art of books. I've got a couple. I've got Art of Star Trek Discovery. That's a great book. I've got The Art of Dan Curry, which is another great book. So, but anyway, enough of Zoom backgrounds. So, Meg, I tell you what, let's get a little bit down to the beginning. So when you were growing up, what was your dream job? What is it that you wanted to do as a child?
So to the best of my memory, the first job I was like, that is a job that humans have. I'm going to be a paleontologist.
Oh, wow.
Dinosaurs. I'm pretty sure the career track went paleontologist, marine biologist specifying in dolphins, veterinarian specifying in large primates, orangutans and gorillas. Then I found out that you didn't have to be dead to have your books published. A misunderstanding we'll get into in a second. And then when I was 8 years old, I read an autobiography of an early Disney storyboard artist named Bill Peet. And I'm like, that's it. That's the job I want. And I got a little talked out of it, you know, through secondary school, because, you know, art's not a real job. I don't know if you've heard that before.
Apparently, art isn't a real job. But
yeah. So my senior year of high school, I was all set to go into international law and relations. I was going to speak three languages and translate for the UN and the Olympics because, you know, I was clever and good in school and people are like, you should go into a career that means something. And thankfully, the summer before I started college, I was earning money at a local stained glass studio in my hometown. And one of my coworkers is like, you never talk about politics and you always talk about movies. I know you draw. Have you thought about going into animation? The college you're going to has a really good animation program. And like all of my childhood dreams kind of exploded out of me at once. And I'm like, yeah, I am going to go into animation. And that's all I've been doing since I was 18 years old is trying to get where I am today. So and it worked. So yay!
When you were like, so in this situation, Meg, as you said, you're reading about kind of like the, you know, the different kind of storyboard artists and things like that. But like when you were growing up, like what were the TV shows, cartoons, etc., or animated movies that really kind of connected with you to kind of, you know, stick with you all the way along? Mm-hmm.
So the first ones that really got me, so I was an early reader and I read big books when I was quite small. And then I saw the 1980s BBC adaptation of the Narnia books.
Yep.
And that sort of sparked this love of adapting books to movies. And so I would read a book that would really get me into a film, or I would find a movie and figure out how to book. To this day, my very favorite movies are the Making of Appendices on the Lord of the Rings Extended Edition DVDs.
Oh, yes.
I watch all 40 hours of that yearly because it's such a great, it's like film school, but you also get to talk about Lord of the Rings at the same time, and like every stop from start to finish. I watched a lot of Star Trek as a kid and Star Wars because my dad was into both, and he got me and my sisters into them all as well. And both of these universes at the time had a very extensive book extended universe as well. I remember fondly, Masks, I think, was my favorite. I remember for a sixth grade project when I was 11 or 12, trying to replicate one of the masks in paper mache from one of the Star Trek books. It was really complex, and I think an overly ambitious project for an 11-year-old who hadn't done paper mache before. But yeah, and what's really fun about, my dad was a big TNG guy. And then my oldest sister got really into Voyager when it started to air. And we, both of them used to tape episodes, you know, whenever they would air on our cable plan. I was six. I don't know how the TV worked back then. But there are like sets of episodes that I remember quite well because that's what we had on VHS. So
yeah.
When Deanna was a cake, you know, Data's dreams, and he dreams Deanna's like a peptide. Yeah. When Geordi ended up getting, oh man, I can't remember what happened, but he basically got syndactyly in his hands and he was like turning all blue.
Yep.
So yeah, as a kid, my favorite characters were Worf, Data, the EMH, and Seven of Nine.
So when you were actually watching Star Trek back in those days, Meg, were you aware that there was an animated series from 73 to 74?
I had no idea because it didn't air. It didn't air on TV, and that's how we got our Star Trek. And then I think in high school is when I first was able to get the full DVD set of TNG from a friend and the full DVD set of Voyager. So I'd seen pieces of it here and there growing up. And it's so funny because Star Trek ended up teaching me a lot about how television worked, even when I was a kid, because I was a huge Reading Rainbow fan as well. And I'm like, that engineer guy looks an awful lot like the host of Reading Rainbow. My dad explained to me that, you know, actors can be more than one person. And I'm like, well, that just sounds amazing. And then another really sweet memory I have of Star Trek, you know, as a precocious reader, you come across words that you don't understand all the time. And I remember scandalizing my poor mother one day at the age of seven saying, "Mom, what's a lesbian?" And
damn you, Star Trek, teaching all these words.
No, that word wasn't from Star Trek, but my mom was like, it's two women who live together like they were married, but they're not. Because it was the 90s. And in my head, so that's what she said. And what I heard was, okay, it's two women who are so beautiful, no man can have them. So all they have in this world is each other, like Deanna Troi and Beverly Crusher. Because those are the two most beautiful women that I knew. And I'm like, okay, I could see that. I could see the two of them saying no to all the men on the ship and just, yeah, so there you go. That's some of my childhood Trek memories. And also, I grew up in Utah, and there is the number one school field trip destination in Utah is a place called the Krista McAuliffe Space Center. And You would, you know, go there for a day trip with your class, and half of the day would be spent in a lecture in their planetarium area talking about science, talking about, you know, what NASA was currently doing. But the other half of the day, they had several classrooms decked out to look like Starfleet ships, and
Oh,
you could
wow.
run a LARP. And so it was at another elementary school, and the older kids, you know, the fifth and sixth grade years, they would play the aliens that would come on the ship or who would talk to you over the monitors. And I loved this because I was the biggest Star Trek nerd in my class at the time. And we went there several times, you know, while I was in elementary school, and I always wanted to get chosen as captain because I'm like, I know how to talk to a Klingon. I know how to talk to a Cardassian. Like, I know what the Borg are. And Ashley has never seen an episode of Star Trek in her life. And I remember this poor Ashley who got chosen as captain of the there were several different sized simulators. The Voyager was 40 people, the Odyssey was 8 people, and the Phoenix was 5. And Ashley got to captain the Voyager. I remember pulling her aside and I'm like, listen, if you talk to a Klingon, and she's like, a what? I'm like, this is important. They're all about honor. And she's like, I'm gonna go. But the last year that I got to go, I did get chosen as captain as one of the smaller ships. And there was this larger boy, because, you know, I was only 11 and he was too, but he definitely got a head start. He was like 8 feet tall. It's ridiculous. And he was the helmsman. And at the end of our simulation, we were supposed to fly through an asteroid field to get away from the, I think, Cardassian ships that were chasing us. And so I'm like, Helm, take us through the asteroid field. And he's like, no, it's too dangerous. I think we should fire on them. And I'm like, shields are at 12%. We're not going to fire on them. Go in the asteroid field. And he just goes, no. And I remember sitting in my chair and taking out, I had an earpiece connected to the teacher in the booth. I remember taking out my earpiece and going, what would Janeway do? And so I stand up to my full 4 foot 8 height and I'm like, you are relieved of duty. And he goes, what? And I said, get out of your chair, stand in the back, and I flew us to the asteroid field. So I had many positive memories of Star Trek even before I started working in animation.
I'm delighted to hear that, like, so many years later, you still remember that memory so absolutely clearly
Yep.
in every single
Formative.
aspect of
Formative.
it. So,
I was
Meg,
born
very
to
jealous.
command.
So, Meg, you made the decision animation is for you. This is the way you're going to kind of do it. When you were learning about it, then, like, was it ever tricky? Was there ever any situation you were there going, wait a second, law really does sound like so much of a better deal than this.
So the school I went to, Brigham Young University, had a very good animation program. Like, they had a great law program, which is why I wanted to go there. And thank goodness they also had an animation program because I was already accepted and I wasn't going to apply anywhere else. But they were very particular about their students because they only accepted 25 new animation students a year.
Wow.
You had to take a year of prerequisite classes and turn in a big portfolio, which is like a completed sketchbook, a animation project, and like, you know, you had to have grades from all the different prerequisite classes. And I was not accepted the first time that I applied. So I got a rejection letter that said, hey, you were actually on the cusp. Basically, they accept 20 kids and then they left 5 spots and they kind of told the second string, take another 6 months, apply again, and we'll see if you'll make it into the school year. And so I applied a second time, did not get it. And
Oh
I'm
no.
like, okay, now it's personal. So I retook the, you know, foundation classes and you know, was also taking time at school to do most of my generals. That's foreshadowing. Time at school to do most of the general courses I would need for my degree. And on my third attempt, they said no, but said, hey, 6 more months, try one more time. And so, you know, I had to take a long moment to look at my life, look at my choices. I really had chased this for a year and a half already. I couldn't go to college forever. And I'm like, you know what? Fourth time's the charm. They don't often tell you this, but I'm pretty sure it's four. And I remember I was driving home from my best friend college roommate's wedding, and a little teary-eyed because, we'd been roommates for the 2 years that I'd been trying, and my family was all out of town. I'd stayed behind to be a bridesmaid, and I was having a little pity party for myself driving home because it had been 2 weeks and I hadn't heard about the animation program, and there was an acceptance letter waiting for me in my mailbox and a fireworks display outside. That wasn't for me, like specifically. It was
Damn it, I thought it was.
it just happened to coincide with the celebration of our town's founding days. And so I got my acceptance letter. Literally no one was home, so I biked to the town park to watch the fireworks and just be so happy and content that I did it and everything would be easy from here on out. Listeners, it was not. That was a very hard program to get through. It was rough start to finish, but I did it. I made it. And I'm like, I'm ready to graduate. And my college is like, so you have to take math to graduate.
What?
I got a C in my advanced computer shader programming class. Doesn't that count? And they're like, no, statistics. And I was like, ugh. It took
Actually,
me 2 years to graduate.
hang on a second. I have to just bring this back for 2 seconds. You said you had a pity party in your car, right? So I need to ask you a question here. What was the song that you always listened to when you had a pity party? We all have a song. I'm curious what your song is.
So I'm pretty sure it would have been da 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 da. Oh, what's that song? Da 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 da.
Yeah, another one.
For some reason I can't explain. Okay, if I just keep singing, I'll figure out the title.
Oh gosh,
I
this is
think it's
driving me mad now,
Pompeii. It's
bro.
Pompeii by Bastille.
That's it.
Oh, okay,
Because
yeah.
in the background, the chorus is singing in Latin. Oh no, oh no. A-A-O, A-O. How and so I'm like, how am I gonna be an optimist about this?
So, fantastic. So eventually you did get out there. You did
I
graduate
did.
eventually. Right. Fantastic
Yeah.
stuff. And
Of
what
my
happened?
favorite subject, maths.
Yeah. Whew.
Listen, my dad was a maths teacher, so I had no choice but to be good at it. Like, so I unfortunately can feel your pain, Megan, in these situations. Math is never a fun topic. Once you got out, where was the like, did you get straight into working, or was it kind of there, like, what the hell do I do here now at this point?
So it took a year of job applications. I think I ended up applying to 50 or 60 different, internships and advertising agencies and studios, all these different areas. Like, thankfully, because of how the animation program at my school worked, I had built relationships with the college recruitment teams at several animation studios. And so I got a lot of very lovely letters that said, "Thank you, but keep trying. You got it. Don't give up." And I'm like, I'm not gonna, like, sunk cost fallacy. If I give up now after spending 7 years in my 3-year animation degree. So in the November after I graduated, I got a 6-month gig that was going to be in Beijing working for an a satellite location of an American special effects house. So I'm like, oh my gosh, I did it. Big break. Sold my apartment contract and got my passport, got my paperwork, and I was gonna fly out 2 weeks before Christmas. And then the project got canceled.
Oh,
And I had
no.
nowhere to live, and I had no money and no prospects, and I'm already a burden on my parents.
Meg, hang
But
on a
so
second. I have to ask you this question. There is a positive part to the story at some point, right? Because so
Well, I'm
far,
directing Star Trek now.
there's a lot of pity parties going on here now, Meg, so far. Like about 20 minutes into the interview, and it's all a pity party.
The key to achieving your dreams is persistence hunting.
Exactly.
Slow and steady,
Wins
kills the prey. So, don't worry,
the
I'll go real fast after this turnaround.
race.
I worked to put myself through school, so I had been having a job while I was trying to graduate at the same time. Probably why it took me so many tries to pass my statistics course. So I made a deal with my parents. I said, "Can I live at home for 3 months, and if I do not have a job within that time frame, I'll go back to lifeguarding at the pool. I'll go back to, yep, you know, a little tiny apartment with five other people, but like, just let me have 3 months to just do art, because I was competing for jobs with people from schools where they weren't. Okay, so like the legends we heard about CalArts was like, you're not even allowed to have a job if you're a CalArts student. All you do is draw. And I'm like, I gotta do that. So I did fan art of a few musicals. I did a video of Wicked that ended up going viral, and I did a Hamilton video as well. And, you know, those are quite old now because this was 2006. So I've improved immensely, but I'm still like quite proud of my Defying Gravity and my Hamilton animations. And so, like I said, I'd been applying to 50 or so jobs, and job 46, which had originally rejected me, called me back 2 months later and says, hey, we have another opening and we remember your previous interview. Would you like to move out to California and work at DreamWorks? And I was like, huh. Yes.
Yes, I would. Who's going to turn that down? I mean, come on.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So I started as a storyboard revisionist at DreamWorks, and we'll get more into like what the jobs entail later, but that's kind of the entry level position of the career track that I wanted, which was, you know, eventually either television showrunner or feature film director. I wanted to do revisionist, board artist, episodic director, and then run my own series.
So you had the complete kind of career ladder kind of planned out then at this point, saying, mm-hmm, oh, brilliant. Okay, very good.
Yeah. I'd been planning this since I was 8, and now I was 26 and I finally got my first job. So, DreamWorks was a huge learning curve because I didn't actually know what a story revisionist did. I would just ask people and they say, oh, it's an entry level storyboard artist. And I'm like, how hard could it be? So when you do animation, we get the story department gets the script from the writers, and it is the storyboard artist's job to do the first draft of the episode. And you typically have 2 to 4 artists. You know, on Lower Decks, we have 4 storyboard artists per episode with our director and sometimes an assistant director. And they do a rough black and white version of the episode, very limited animation, but with every background drawn in, every prop drawn in, and the initial acting choices for the characters. And board artists have 6 weeks to complete their section of the script, and then they move on to the next episode. And after those 6 weeks, the director, you know, looks over the thing as a whole and decides, okay, we need better continuity here, or I'd like to juice up this character arc here. And we call for a round of notes, you know, retakes. If we were live action, this would be, you know, going back on set to do retakes, but it's all drawn. So revisionists are the retake storyboard artists, and they'll take notes from their director. And it could be a note as simple as, this character should have a hat through this whole scene. Or it could be as complex as, we need to restage this fight sequence in a new area. So it's a way to sort of practice doing a simplified version of storyboarding before you're expected to start turning around 8 to 12 pages on your own.
So, Meg, do you mind me ask? Sorry, Mike, go on.
Is this done digitally or is it done pen to paper?
So it is done pen to digital paper.
Okay.
I have a big touch. I have a touch screen monitor. And so I am holding a physical tablet pen, but I am drawing digitally.
You've got a Wacom and you just use that.
That's it. That's the one. Yep.
So when you would have started out, Meg, would it have been digital at that point, or would it still kind of pen to normal paper at that point?
It was digital at that point, but it was in Photoshop, which wasn't really designed for a lot of sequential art. Photoshop is sort of designed for like singular finished images, but life finds a way. So when I started, there were some shows that were still we're still doing traditional. I think SpongeBob did a lot of their boards traditional. I think Steven Universe, when it first started out, did, you know, pencil to paper. And as production schedules have shortened over the years and certain jobs have been phased out of animation and more responsibility has fallen on the board artists. We, as like a whole, we've started using more and more sophisticated programs. And so now most shows specifically use Storyboard Pro from Toon Boom, which has a timeline editor. You can add sound, you can time out your boards. So instead of just sending 500 still images to your editor, you can space out, you know, rough timing so the editor has a early assembly to work from instead of assembling the entire episode from scratch.
And if you were, say, doing a kind of a storyboard revision, say, now versus back then, like, what's the time difference in terms of how long it takes? Like, I'm guessing back in 06, it was a hell of a lot longer than it was in 2023.
So it was 2016. I'm not in my 50s yet, but we're getting closer every day.
Sorry, I'm
listen, time's not real anymore.
I'm probably the oldest person here on this podcast anyway, so like... time kind of changes very quickly for me.
And it's wibbly wobbly, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff. Yep.
So it really depends on the need. So like I said, the board artists, they have their episode for 6 weeks, and then the director will turn over a new version of the episode every 2 to 3 weeks for the next 3 months. So sometimes it's like, hey, you can have a whole week on this. And sometimes it's like, hi, it's 10 a.m. I need this by noon, please. I think I've only done that to one revisionist in my most recent season, and I felt really badly. I'm like, listen, I can't get to this, and we have an edit tonight. So as a director now, I draw a lot of the retakes myself as well.
Okay.
It's more like divvying up the work. So when a season of Star Trek Lower Decks first starts, I'm only overseeing one episode at a time. You know, my board artists give me their roughs. I will do a lot of notes and draw overs at the halfway point for them, and then they'll turn over the clean episode. And then I'm doing my version one that I have to turn over to both the studio and to our showrunner. And I also get notes from our awesome supervising director, Barry, who I believe you have talked to on an earlier episode.
Yep.
So I will now be turning around the first episode while giving notes to my board artists on their second episode. And then when they wrap the second episode, I'll be giving notes on their third, doing first turnarounds on the second, and doing second turnarounds on the first. And there will be about a 2 to 3 week point in each season where I am like spinning plates under three episodes at the same time. So it starts off very light. So as a board artist, you kind of have a consistent workload over the season with like 6 weeks, 6 weeks, six weeks. And as a director, it's more like a and then it tapers off at the end.
And Meg, of all the episodes that you worked as a storyboard artist on across all the different shows that you worked on, what's your favorite one that you what episode did you enjoy working on most?
So I am immensely proud of a Camp Cretaceous episode. So I have one Camp Cretaceous episode and one Lower Decks episode that are like tied in my heart. And so Camp Cretaceous was a kids television show that took place concurrently with the Chris Pratt Jurassic World movie. Yep. It was about a group of campers who were the first testers of an incredible dinosaur themed adventure camp. And listen, my childhood paleontology dreams like all came true because I could stand up in meetings and be like, the Parasaurolophus. But
so you're the only one that could pronounce the dinosaur's name. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. So the kids go to this adventure camp. But it's during the events of Jurassic World, so everything falls to shit. And these kids are stuck at the north end of the island, and the first season follows them trying to make it to the south end of the island to the evacuation ferries.
Oh,
and
yeah.
In episode 7 of the first season, they have finally made it to a monorail. It's night. They've been running all day. And as they're, you know, riding this brightly lit monorail down the track, it draws the attention of a flock of pteranodons that had bust out of the aviary earlier that day. So I got to do this 8-minute epic chase sequence, violent sequence, you know, glass exploding and, you know, moving from car to car to find safety. And it ends, spoilers, with a bit of a tragic twist. And it was such a great assignment to start out the season on. And I like deeply love what I did on that action scene. And then my favorite storyboards, before I directed, my favorite storyboards on Lower Decks was in season 3, episode 5, Reflections, which is the Rutherford and who we called Red Rutherford episode. And I got to do the back third of that episode. So from the start of the race to the end of the episode. So the final moment they have in that white space, you know, saying goodbye and he fades away. And my director at the time, Mike Mullen, he really let me kind of stretch beyond what the script called for creatively. So the flashes we see of Rutherford at like all the different stages of being injured. And I got to add a little bit of graffiti to the brig at the end. Cause you know, Mariner has this, you know, Mariner's HQ, and it's Boimler's first time in the brig. And I'm like, I bet to make him feel better, Mariner. And so there's another little graffiti next to it called Boimler's Guest House. And that made it clear through to final because, you know, board artists have it first, but then our showrunner and our network and our supervising director and our viz dev department, like the episode gets reviewed many, many, many times. So it's not like I snuck it in and nobody noticed. No, I put it in and they liked the pitches that I had for this episode and it made it through to final. So that's my favorite Lower Decks that I boarded on.
Actually, wait a second. Just as you're saying that, then Meg, you just said there, you know, they're reviewed several times. You can't sneak anything in. Do you ever try to sneak something in?
No, I would never do that. But I will tell you what. Now that I'm a director, board artists is trying to get stuff past me. And I'm like, the butt would not jiggle that much. And part of my job that I really regret sometimes is being a buzzkill. So I'm always telling people you can't run like Naruto in an episode. But in season 4, episode 5, in Pathological Fallacies, I said, okay, Gene. Once. Kayshawn can run like that one time only because we have 6 other people running in frame and I want something visually distinct. And do you know what? Who knows? Maybe Temerians actually run like that. They didn't show it in the Darmok episode.
Because the second you said it, I was there going, wait a second.
They're running like so you know, I cut other instances of it out. It's all about, you know, choosing when to exaggerate reality for animation.
So in your time then as storyboard artist, you now moved into doing some directing as well. Like, basically, was this the moment where you said, I'm going to go for it here on Star Trek Lower Decks? Or had you tried previously? Or was it just in Lower Decks you said, I'm going to go for it here?
I had tried previously. I had tried for, I think, about 18 months before Lower Decks said yes. So I storyboarded on seasons. So I moved up from being a revisionist to being a full-time board artist in 2018. Mm-hmm. And then once 2020 hit and I was working from home, I made what I believe was a tactical error and I freelanced on multiple shows at once. And I staggered them. So like the easiest part of storyboarding this one would overlap with the most difficult part of here. And I ended up stacking up some really cool shows on, you know, my IMDb credits page. I did a few episodes for a sci-fi show at Titmouse called Pantheon. And I worked for on a Netflix musical that sadly got canceled. And I did a few episodes of Transformers for Nickelodeon. And so I started getting experience in all these different shows. And once 2020 hit, I told my talent manager, who's like an agent, but fancier, I said, I want to start interviewing to be a director. I believe I interviewed to be an assistant director on Prodigy, but ended up being accepting a role as a board artist on Lower Decks instead. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why I was eventually able to move up on Lower Decks is because of how tightly our schedules are packed, a board artist will only be on Lower Decks for 18 to 24 weeks, depending on which team you're on. And then you find other freelance or another short season over the course of the year. But of course, you can't guarantee that schedules will line up perfectly. So we can't always get the exact same teams back every year. And that ends up creating more room for upwards trajectory on our ship. I mean, that's why Harry Kim didn't get promoted in Voyager, is nobody left the ship when they died. And it's why, you know, people can move up so quickly on other examples of Starship. So my director, Mike Mullen, who led our team for season 3, he was not able to come back for season 4. So I asked our supervising director and our line producer, when I was leaving season 3, I said, hey, if there's a director spot for season four, I really would like to go for it. And like I said, I'd been interviewing a lot of other places, and I'm such a pro at getting rejected. I mean, you heard the travails of college.
The 50 rejection letters later, yep.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was turned down for multiple shows as a director because they're like, you don't have any directing experience. And I'm like, I did a short film in college. That didn't count. And I'm like, I also directed an official fake trailer for the Adventure Zone podcast. And they're like, yeah, but you haven't been a real director. And I'm like, how am I supposed to get in if no one will give me a chance? And I'm so grateful to Megan and Barry for giving me my chance on season four of Lower Decks. I got to do three really awesome episodes I deeply love, and clearly Michael does too, because he's got a Moopsie shirt.
we're gonna discuss those episodes in a minute, but yeah.
Just one thing to make, like, obviously from point of view, say with live action, I know people have said that once they've stepped behind the camera, the relationship is different. Obviously, look, animation is different. How did you find the transition going to being a director rather than kind of being the storyboard artist? Like, how did you find your interaction with your storyboard artist then, having, you know, being moved up for the first time?
Yeah, so a lot of, not necessarily imposter syndrome, but trying to be aware that this was my first time and I was going to mess up. And someone I really need to thank on this podcast is Jeffrey New, who is our story production coordinator on Lower Decks. I've joked with him before. It was very much like being in some kind of fairy tale where a commoner is bumped up to royalty and you're meeting ambassadors and you're like, what are their customs and what time should the episode be exported on Friday? And he's like, bow deeply from the waist and network needs it by 4 p.m. And I'm like, great, thanks. So, you know, I'll be in meetings just, you know, smiling and nodding and then also messaging Jeffrey to be like, okay, what's next? What do I do? Thankfully, knowing people both above and around me in the production, it was such an easy transition because I'd been on the show for two seasons already. Yeah. I knew the crew, I knew the show, and thank goodness I'd figured out how to draw by then. And so it was honestly the easiest and most wonderful transition to a promotion that I could have asked for. It felt really sweet to do it in parallel with our Lower Deckers as they move up to being Lieutenant Junior Grades.
Yep.
And just in terms of, say, like, you know, you've always wanted to be a director, and when you had the chance, what was the biggest challenge you found of actually doing it? And also, was the role exactly what you thought it was, or was it different in any way?
The role was very... like, you know, I'd been trying for this for 2 years and I love research. So I had a pretty good grasp on what the role would entail. The hours are quite different. And like I mentioned, as a board artist, you have a pretty steady, you know, which weeks are going to be high intensity, you know, which weeks are going to be lower. So, you know, as a board artist, I'm like, okay, I know I can work really hard this week because I will have a lighter assignment starting next week. And as a director with the, you know, the notes and the changes that I'm asked for at, you know, different stages of revisions, I could be thinking, oh, thank goodness, a light week. And then Mike McMahon very fairly says, so you made the caves really nice and I need smaller original series caves and not Discovery caves. And I'm like, oh. So I will say the hardest time that I had on season four, and there's no way Mike could have known this was coming, I ended up getting COVID for the first time and food poisoning for the first time on a week that was my birthday. And I had to restage the entirety of the caves episode. And I'm it was like living in my own caves episode because I just worked from home the whole week and was like, no one has to hear the sounds my body is making. And I'm just going to take all video calls with the camera off.
And Meg, just in terms of the last question I asked you in directing, what was it like when you saw your name show up as directed by for the very first time?
Were you as happy as your tweet?
Well, here's the thing. The first time I saw my title credit, my name was incorrect.
Oh, no.
on my IMDb page, I'm credited as Megan Lloyd because I think it looks more grown up and serious. Plus, I like having the five letters in the first name, five letters in the second name. Symmetry, balance, yeah. That sort of thing. Yep. But our line producer on Lower Decks, her name is Megan. And therefore, as the senior Megan, she gets to use the full name. And I go by Meg day to day on the show. And like also on the internet. Like I'm Meg on yep. the internet. Mm. So I had written in the official Google Doc that we fill out, what is your official credit? How would you like your name spelled? I had put in Megan Lloyd. But there were just temp credits that were laid over. So the first one I directed was season 4, episode 2, I Have No Bones Yet I Must Flee. And I was like so excited watching the final color cut. I'm like, here it comes. Incorrect. Okay. So I messaged Jeffrey, my trusted advisor, and was like, hey, who do I ask about getting my name correct? But, when it aired, it was like, I've been doing this for, 12 years at this point, and I did it. I'm at literally the halfway point of my career where I want to be getting that first director credit.
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Well done, Meg. Absolutely great story.
Thank you.
So let's talk about that episode, shall we? Which is my favorite episode of the season.
Thank you. That's so nice.
Although
to hear.
I haven't seen next week's yet, but
have you seen today's?
I have seen today's.
No.
Okay. I will say nothing.
I missed it. I haven't had a chance to watch it just yet.
Today's is all I'm my say favorite on that of the season. I didn't even work on it, and it's my favorite of the season. Brandon Williams, who directed that one, and Bob Suarez, who directed the season finale, they did an absolutely phenomenal job on the last two episodes of the season.
All I'm going to say is plot twist. Did not see that coming. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, a plot twist I had personal nightmares about spoiling, and I'm so happy I've made it this far. And so if I can make it the rest of the interview without spoiling it for show, then perfect score.
Okay, so let's talk about I Have No Bones Yet I Must Flee, which is the best episode of the season. Where did Moopsie come from?
Oh my
gosh. I have to ask. So, let's
animation.
Start with that.
Animation is the biggest team project of all time because the writers, start with the idea, which is just like a small blob of a creature. And our visual development team will come up with two or three different versions. And they hit on the Moopsie that you see, like pretty close to it. There was, like that one. There was one that was maybe more furry and one that had, maybe more teeth. And Mike will narrow down on the visuals of what he likes. So by the time we started the storyboards, we knew what, Moopsie from the side and Moopsie from the front and a picture of Moopsie with his mouth open. And the specific direction that I gave my board artist is for specific scenes, I asked for specific animal behaviors. Because there was always this balance of like, is the Moopsie intentionally malicious? Is it like a hunter? And we decided, no, it's a goofy, dumb animal that's just like, I have no bones and I must eat. So I think Mike's original pitch for it was that it should feel way more like the rabbit from Monty Python, where it just appears in places. But I, as a almost paleontologist and potential zoologist focusing in large primates, I love, what are the logics of animal locomotion? So Moopsie's walk cycle that you see where it toddles back and forth, that is based off specific videos of moles walking above ground that I passed on to my artists. And my assistant director for the first two episodes of season 4, her name is Belle O. She's actually an animation director on the show as well. And because she is such a treasure, and we don't want to lose her off the show in between seasons because, everything works as sort of an assembly line. They asked her if she would join the story team while they were waiting for the animation team to start back up again. And I honestly would credit a lot of Moopsy's final success to the fact that we had an animator working with me on the notes, on the boards, and so she knew exactly what I wanted from Moopsy. So a fun Moopsy moment that got cut is one of our board artists, Jean, in the script, it talks about Moopsy walking over the controls. And this is at the point when we were still testing, how smart is the Moopsy? Is this on purpose? Is this all instinct? And she had done this great shot. I don't know if you've seen the bongo cat gif.
Yes, on the internet. I've seen it. Yeah,
cartoon
yeah, yeah.
cat. Yep. So yeah. She pretty much drew Moopsy as the bongo cat, just like smacking the keyboard, which is very cute. But that instead got turned to his little mole walk, where he accidentally tripped on it. And then the heart and soul of the Moopsy. So before our voice actors come on board, our storyboard artists still need a vague audio timed out radio play of the episode before we start. And so our dialogue editor, Ray, will act out the entire episode from start to finish and put in temp music and sound effects. And there are times where, like, we get the final voices in and I'm like, man, I miss how Ray delivered that line. all of our voice actors are phenomenal. It's so funny to hear Ray's voice pitched up to be Tendi and Mariner, and like for it to be pitched down to be Shax. And like, I can still hear the specific lilt of his Rutherford. Anyway, it's great. I love it. Well, to voice the Moopsy, because he was working from home, he actually had his son, who was 9 at the time, just record a couple Moopsy, Moopsy. And it was such a stirring performance, I'm sure you can agree, that I don't get to make any casting decisions. That's not my department. That's not my role. But casting did make the effort to officially record him as the Moopsy. So
oh, that's awesome. That's brilliant.
He got to come through the final episode. So the innocence of a child in the body of a killer.
In a great big marshmallow.
Specific, yeah. Yes. Another specific animal moment is one of my board artists, Spencer Johnson, when Moopsy is chugging the swamp. Oh my gosh.
I can't remember what
the gobble. Yeah, they only gobble you. The swamp gobblers only gobble you. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a moment where Moopsy is like got one up above his head and starts chugging it and then shaking it. He'd found video of a baby owl trying to swallow an entire rat. And he's like, this is what I'm going for. And I'm like, go for it, man. And then animation just turned that shake out. So cute.
I think my favorite little moment in that scene is after he's chugged the swamp gobbler and he's just flopping around out.
Mole, yeah.
I just love it. Yeah. I want more Moopsy. Okay. Please bring Moopsy back. Moopsy. That's we need Moopsy in season 5.
That's not my call. Unfortunately, I draw the scripts that they... Sorry. Fortunately, I draw the scripts that they give me. Unfortunately, we don't get to even choose which episodes we're on because, you know, I was hired as the slot of the Team 2 director. So I knew going in it would be episodes 3, 5, and 8, but I didn't know, like, what the episodes would be. Yep. So an example of some things that change from the initial boards to the final is once they got into the room... once they got into the control room with the lights off, and we made sure that Narge was the one like leading the chase. So it wasn't like, oh, how did we randomly end up in the main control room? I'm like, no. Narge is in front. Narge would be the one who would take them there because he thinks it's the most fortified. But we kind of lost the Moopsy during the Mariner and Jack argument. So Belle did a revision, and that's Moopsy jumping into the door and bouncing off just like a rubber ball. And if you listen, you hear Moopsy hit the door a few more times in the scene, but then it stops. And the characters inside don't notice because we have this great emotional moment between Jack and Mariner. That's when the Moopsy is climbing the ladder outside the door to get into the vents. And then in the final moments of the Jack Mariner storyline where she's about to sacrifice herself, we had this specific window set up. And the idea was that, oh yeah, this specific window will be enough to, you know, the Moopsy's behind the door. And I'm like, we got to see the Moopsy. We got to see it one more time. And so I added in the little jump when he's coming up above the window, and then his eyes get bigger when he see when he sees the teeth, and then he just sticks on it like a lamprey or like a Minok from Star Wars, a movie that I love.
Jeez. Meg, we set ground rules at the start of this podcast.
You killed
I don't
every
understand
thing.
Why.
I
I don't
love
understand
so
this.
Many things. It makes me a better artist. Anyway.
It's not like I have the Millennium Falcon right there over my right shoulder.
So, Meg, we need to set up a petition to bring Moopsie back.
Oh, 100%. Good Lord. Yeah.
I can't be involved in that. I don't want to annoy Mike. I want to keep coming back. So
Meg has created 1,000 email addresses for this petition.
So, Meg, a question.
Forge a lot of signatures.
Meg, question for you then. Who, because like I'm a huge fan of the animated series episode The Survivor. It was actually one of the very first episodes I really kind of connected with when I saw. Mm-hmm. And obviously, who were in that? The Vendorians. And where did the Vendorians end up in? Caves, of course.
Caves.
Who in their right mind said, you know what? We're going to go back to the animated series and bring the Vendorians back. I love it. I was absolutely delighted to see them again. But whose idea was it?
I am not 100% sure who chose the Vendorians, because when I read the first outline of the script, there were, I think they were coming up with an original alien first.
Yeah.
And then someone in the writer's room must have been like, why don't we just pull? We had, so Lower Decks had a single Vendorian appear already in season one, episode two, yeah. Envoys. Yep. There's a moment where an Andorian is disguised. And I'm so glad that we brought them back, because I think the animation of the Vendorians is some of my favorite of the season. So we're not like a paper, traditionally hand-animated show. We mm-hmm. use built puppets. It's more like extremely complex paper dolls that have digital joints that can be posed. And our animators can also swap out and redraw faces. So like if a special pose is needed, they will, of course, draw original animation for it.
Yep.
So you've got to think of the build of a tentacle. You know, an arm just has a couple different joints to worry about. And a tentacle has, like, it's joints all the way down. And Vendorians are multi-tentacled. And we've got, like, 20 of them in every scene. And they all move a unique way. And even though they don't have mouths, they've got such evocative facial expressions. And because our senior staff characters aren't present in Caves, but the voice actors are like still credited in the episode. Don and Jerry and Fred, who typically voice Freeman, Ransom, and Shax, they voice the Vendorians. It's not that the senior staff is secretly disguised as Vendorians. you can listen throughout the whole series and hear those three, and also Jillian, who plays Dr. Tana, will voice multiple characters.
Other characters, yeah, exactly. Like, one of the things I loved about the Vendorians, in Caves, is just I love the kind of the detail on the faces and the heads of all the Vendorians to make them all just, they're all so unique and they're all so different. And like, I love the fact that you took the idea from 1973 and upgraded it in such a unique way to kind of make this a kind of like a society in one goal with just such a small group of characters.
Mm-hmm. And a little Easter egg for you guys is when Boimler and Levy are first passing through the cave, and Boimler hears something behind him and he spins around with his flashlight. And he says, "What was that?" Before he spins around, there are two stalagmites in the foreground. And then as his light hits the camera, when it passes, one of them is vanished. To indicate even that early on in the episode that there is something in the cave watching them and following them.
Oh, man. Absolutely.
Gotta
brilliant.
Watch it again.
Exactly.
100%. But Meg, what's the future then? What, like, obviously you hope to be back for season 5 of Lower Decks. I'm guessing, right? You're not going to tell us you're not going to come back.
Hopefully more. We had Mike and Alex Kurtzman hosted the New York Comic Con panel last week, and Mike talked about how he's writing season 5. Until more is announced, that's all I can talk about. But I would be happy to continue to return animating and directing more Star Trek. More Trek all the time. 10 seasons in a movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
At a minimum, yes.
You know, just to get warmed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Meg, we've one last question for you then, the question that we always ask our guests, and Mike as our host, and I've stolen the show completely from you. What is our last question we always ask?
It's super easy, doesn't take any thinking whatsoever.
Great, so, I never do that anyway.
Meg Lloyd, what does Star Trek mean to you?
Oh, infinite diversity and infinite combinations is a theme that I love. Star Trek to me means a hopeful future that will go on even if a world ends.
Beautiful.
Love it, because that's exactly, I'm exactly the same.
Yes. We're on a wavelength today.
just in it. Well, Meg, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute delight. Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. To everybody else, thank you for listening and watching. If you'd like to catch up with more Clone Star Pod, make sure you check out clonestarpod.com for incredible fan art and blogs written by you, our wonderful Star Trek fans. Until next time, live long and prosper.